outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Well, Kyle, have you ever been to the Huntington Library in Pasadena?
I have been to the Huntington Library in Pasadena.
That's quite a place, isn't it?
It is gorgeous.
For those that don't know, Sarah and I are on a spring garden tour of the gardens of Los Angeles. So a couple weeks ago, we went to Descanso Gardens, which we'd never been to, and we've never been to the Huntington Gardens, which is, like most of these places, an old rich man's house who spent the last part of his life developing 170 acres of gardens. Which, but I just pray Sarah never gets that kind of acreage because that would just kill me. But so we went there and rundered around for the morning, and gosh, what a beautiful place.
What was your favorite garden there?
Oh, probably, I think both of us would say the roses.
Yeah.
I'm not much for the Chinese, Japanese garden kind of look. I know I got friends who love that look. I'm more of the... I found the desert very interesting, though. We're going to skip it, and then we could see it from a distance going, whoa, there's a lot going on over there.
There's a lot going on in the desert section, way more than you might think.
Yeah, I've been to the desert. It doesn't look like that.
No.
We were in the Australia part of the garden, which that was just a few eucalyptus trees and a lot of dirt. And I'm thinking, okay, Australia does look like this.
Yes.
No kangaroos, but other than that, it was all there. And then you get in the desert and go, oh my gosh, I've never seen so much color and unique plants. And but then get up to the rose garden. There's, I don't know how many rose bushes, few hundred. They were just,
there's so many.
All out in their glory. So we had a great day touring a couple of gardens here in Los Angeles.
I actually have very fond memories of the Huntington Library Gardens.
Is that a date place for you and Jess?
I wrote the first letter ever that I ever wrote to Jess. I wrote in the Huntington Gardens down by the Chinese or Japanese garden. And then I proposed to her in the same spot.
Oh, so wow.
I actually proposed to her in the spot that I wrote my first love letter to her.
Jess has some great memories. You should have told her. We'd have gone to the bench and genuflected or something.
No, it was great. So they actually at the Huntington Library, they have high tea there. And so I took Jess on a date to go out for high tea. And then unbeknownst to her, my mom was actually there with a telephoto lens. And so we had high tea together and then walked down to the bench where I wrote my first love letter to her. And I proposed to her there and my mom was taking pictures and very nice experience.
And she said yes.
Eventually. No, she said yes. She said yes.
All afternoon to talk her into this, but she finally did.
It was a great spread. If you ever like high tea, it was wonderful. I didn't eat very much because I was so nervous that I didn't have an appetite, and Jess was giving me a hard time. She was wondering what was going on. So, yeah.
I can tell you, Sarah and I had absolutely zero interest in high tea. We found
a
couple of tea houses and went, okay, we don't drink tea, first of all. And the food's kind of, shall we say, pretentious. And so we just moved on.
That's fair. I can't argue with that, but it is a good experience.
I can't imagine a cattle rustler from Wyoming enjoying high tea at the Huntington Library and Gardens.
I am a diversified rancher. We'll just put it that way.
You are, for sure. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. Best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
It's actually a bell hooks quote. And it's
a it who goes, quote?
Bell hooks.
Okay, I don't know bell hooks. Friend of yours?
Author. Really, really good author.
Okay.
Her comment was, many of us seek community solely to escape the fear of being alone. Knowing how to be solitary is central to the art of loving. When we can be alone, we can be with others without using them as a means of escape.
Oh.
So I really enjoyed that because I thought back to a comment that a friend of mine made when we were up in the mountains and we were doing some fly fishing together and stuff. And he asked me, like, how often do I come up here and spend time by myself? And I was like, I try to come up at least a couple times a year and do a couple overnights. And And his comment back was, wow, your closet must be pretty clean. And I looked at him and I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah, and he's like, your head must be okay. Like he said, I often want to come and do things like this, but I have to do them with other people because if I'm by myself, then my thoughts torment me. It got into this whole dialogue about being able to be at rest with yourself alone and how that impacts the way that we are with others. And so I was actually preparing for one of my classes and came across this quote from bell hooks and just thought it was.
Yeah. Even the language of how you're using others to quiet whatever's going on in you. And now we're not really having community. We're having the exploitation of each other for our own personal needs, which unfortunately is a lot of what religion does to us.
Oh man.
So particularly when you try and build it off of, you need fellowship, you need community, you build it on need. And then people wonder why it isn't fun. Why it isn't joyful? Why doesn't it come not as I need this, but I get this. I get to have community.
I think largely because anytime you place an obligation on it and then attach your existential well-being to the fact that you have to go and be a part of this, then it steals the freedom of being able to enjoy people for who they are. Right. Because again, it comes back to I'm using you in order to fulfill a check mark in being a good Christian or adhering to what I'm supposed to do in order to be in good standing with God, because, you know, I don't want to neglect the gathering of the saints. And so I'm going to be there instead of being able to be present with the community of people that God has placed around you.
Even if people prey on that need for belonging, that sense of belonging.
Yes. Yeah.
If you have that need and that need's being exploited for that kind of thing, there's no end to the ways you can be manipulated.
No.
If you don't find your belonging in Christ and then your joy of community and fellowship with other people, not because you have to, not because it's got to fill an empty hole in your heart, but because God's given you brothers and sisters on a great journey and you get to share that adventure together.
Well, and it allows those people to be wherever they're at in their journey.
Yep.
That was the other element of that is like, well, you have to be with people that are sharpening you. You know, iron sharpens iron. So you have to be with people that meet X category of things.
Yes.
And instead of being able to just simply enjoy the incredible people that God has placed around me. And the fact that just because they don't adhere to the same life credos that whatever denomination espouses to doesn't mean that they aren't a valuable beloved of Christ that I can deeply be impacted by and grow as a person and enjoy as a human being.
Yeah. I can't imagine people that are tormented being alone. I've played a lot of golf alone. I like going early light and don't always have people that are willing to go that early.
Yeah.
Man, 18 holes with myself and God and just talking and communing, it's better than fly fishing. I'll just say it that way.
That's a reach.
It's such a great time. And I always tell Sarah, I'm great company on a golf course. I really enjoy being with me if there's no one else around. But then you got somebody that you enjoy playing golf with, then that's good too. Unless they smoke cigars and always stand upwind of you. Just no place on a golf course for that kind of thing.
Man, we can't fly fish together. Now you just told me I can't golf with you, or I at least have to stand upwind. Okay.
Stay downwind. You put the ugly, disgusting thing in your mouth. Anyway, my best thing I heard last week was a shocker because it was in a secular TV series that didn't see this coming. The series called 1923. It's settling Montana in the Wild West. And I mean, it's just full of murder and mayhem. And it's, you know, the Sopranos in the West kind of a thing. In the middle of it, the lady, the Helen Mirren character, says, as she's explaining to a young lady that's with her in the house, and they're being assaulted by an army outside, wants to take their land. She says, take the Ten Commandments. Shouldn't be too difficult to follow. Don't kill. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't covet. And that's the one, Elizabeth, that will lead you to commit all the others. Desiring what someone else has, his land, his money, his wife, that has led to every atrocity this world has ever seen. You watch, the human race will covet itself right out of existence.
Whoa.
Yes.
That's in 1923?
Yes. And I just went, okay, that's Toby. That's the way, you know,
wow.
The first nine commandments are prohibitions of action. The last one is prohibitions of desire. And you can't win over desire by discipline, by action. You have to actually find life in something else so that then when the coveting one yields to the life of Jesus, then the other ones you don't even need, because the desire always precedes the action.
Yeah,
and it's the evil desires that are the problems, not desire, because God's given us the capacity to desire. There's much desire that's lovely and beautiful and wonderful.
Yes.
But when our desires turn to things that are not ours, and we begin to covet stuff, then we'll do stuff because we're coveting stuff. And I sent that to Toby as soon as I sent it to him going, dude, you got to hear this. I figure you wrote this part of the screenplay. He said he didn't, but he's curious who did. Because that's pretty insightful right there.
I love that. That's the beauty, though, of getting surprised by the kingdom truth, no matter where you find it. I mean, that's the beauty of it is, watching a show like that and then all of a sudden just getting blindsided by a nugget of truth in the midst of that. I love that.
Because there's not much redeemable about the rest of the story. Sarah and I are watching this going, this is just ridiculous. And then out of that pops this little nugget of going, okay, that's it right there. You watch, the human race will covet itself right out of existence. And man, we are living in that time for sure.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yes, we are.
That was from 1923. So 100 years later, we're still doing it on steroids. Yeah. So did you see the Catholic funeral this week for Pope Francis?
I caught the highlight reel of the, I don't even know how to categorize the experience, to be honest, that unfolded in front of my eyes.
I don't know what to do about it, huh?
I don't know what to do with it.
First one you've ever seen.
It is. I don't normally watch that type of thing. I mean, I know, especially when I was living in Spain, it was really interesting to see the influence of the Catholic Church and just how it impacts their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, there was so much invested and I feel torn, right? Because there's honoring a person who lived, I would say, in a lot of regards, lived a genuine life of service and care for other people and a desire to influence the world in a positive way. And yet, wow, like the amount of people that were there, and I don't know, I had very mixed feelings about it.
I watch all these things. I find this whole thing fascinating. I've been to St. Peter's Square. I've been to St. Peter's Basilica. I've been there. So we traversed some of that tiled walkways and ornate whatever it is. But I watch these things. And I find it fascinating with how we got from the ministry of Jesus to stuff like this.
Yes.
That intrigues me. But as I'm watching it, Sarah doesn't have the same interest. So she's kind of coming in and out of the room while I'm watching it. It was on at 1 a.m. here. So I didn't watch it live, watched it later. And I said, you know what? I'm thinking about if the Catholics are right, we're in a heap of trouble.
Okay. Do tell.
if this is what the life of Jesus was meant to produce, and I am thoroughly appalled by most of it.
Yeah.
Now I can appreciate the man and the leader that Pope Francis was. I think, you know, Pope John Paul, there've been some good popes in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But there've been some scandalous popes in past centuries and generations.
Yes.
So I'm not partial to the system in which that incubates, but for a man like St. Francis, what we know of him, his public persona anyway. I don't know what he is behind the scenes. I don't know how he got up there to be in charge of all that, other than he was voted on by 2/3 of the people in the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
But it's more confusing when you have a pope like that, a man who seems to be connected to Jesus and seems to have love in his heart for the downcast and downtrodden and the marginalized people. I mean, he had that love and he invested his time living a simple life, didn't live in the papal palace, didn't take on a lot of the stuff. So you got to admire him for that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm thinking, but you're in charge of this whole massive operation.
Yes.
Of stuff that is 2,000 years old, of like some of the computer programs I have who get to be 20 years old, and they've added so much to it, it doesn't work anymore for what I originally got the program for. And you got to wonder that about Catholicism. When you think, this is the only thing we had for 1,000 years. This is how the Church of Jesus Christ grew up into 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries. It became this worldwide empire. Yeah. Which, and definitely has more the feel of empire than it does community.
Yeah.
And to know how you got to, you know, every diocese, every region of the Catholic Church back in the 3rd, 4th centuries, they all had a bishop of Rome, bishop of Antioch, bishop of Alexandria, bishop of whatever. And then somewhere in all that, the bishop of Rome won the fight to be the primary bishop. So St. Francis is the bishop of Rome, but that makes him the pope.
Yeah.
And that puts everything in Catholicism under him and whoever fills that spot.
Yeah.
But I find all this, I find the opulence of it. I find the absurd costumes to be, and I know people be offended by those words, but I'm sorry. I can't imagine the first time you put on cardinal robes, if you're a serious follower of Jesus, you think, what am I doing?
Yeah.
What does it take to get there? And now we've got charismatic denominations who are very much doing the same kind. They're having bishops and robes, and they're following that. What is it about the life of Jesus or the pretense of the life of Jesus that leads to this kind of arrangement of extensive costumes, leadership hierarchies? I watch it both to honor who Pope Francis was and to negotiate, how did we get here? And who am I to say, okay, that can't be right. That can't be what God had in mind. If it was, I should join. I should be part of that. But there's nothing about my walk with Jesus that leads me to say, yeah, this looks like it would be helpful.
Well, and a lot of the things that I see in not only just the modern Catholic Church, but, you know, some of these other evangelical churches as well, is very similar characteristics of the Sadducees during that time, right? During Jesus' time, mm-hmm. because they're like, okay, here comes Rome. We don't want to lose our power and influence. And so we're going to align ourselves with some argue the wealthiest person who has ever lived, and we're going to align and make him our king. And awesome. Now all of a sudden we maintain our level of power and authority and control. And I mean, even like historically looking at the differences between the Sadducees' homes/palaces in comparison to the Pharisees' homes/huts, houses, you know,
I mean, shacks.
Not the opulence and wealth and man, it's challenging because I don't think any of this, to be honest, has anything to do with the life of Christ. I think it has everything to do with the brokenness of humanity. And you take a system that is has been in development for a couple thousand years, and now all of a sudden you have a multi-billion dollar corporation that also happens to have God's name next to it. I mean, this literally was the institutional system that authored the necessity for separation of church and state in the American Constitution, right? They look back at the Catholic Church and then its influence, because it was the state religion for so long in Europe or in England. Then the King of England wants to get a divorce, and so he starts Protestantism. And
you know, he didn't start Protestantism, but he went to the Anglican form of
Catholicism. He went to the Anglican. Yes, yeah. Yes. And it was like, okay, I'm going to become the head of the Church of England now. And so it's like, what? I mean, okay.
And right before the Puritans started coming to America, It was the King of England switched 11 times over his life between Protestant and Catholic, depending on who would give him permission to do what he wanted.
To do what he wanted to do. Yes.
And that usually involved divorcing one wife to get another.
Yes.
And how he could get that okayed. But you look at all the infrastructure around that, which has been tacked on year after year. You look at these bishops sitting in their seats in these red lace gowns. And you go, what, how did the life of Jesus morph into that? And how does it continue to convince a significant, 1.4 billion Catholics worldwide growing, say, well, it's dying here in the West. And it may be less in the West, but in Africa, it's just, the Catholic Church is blowing up. It's just huge. And so what is it about our spiritual hunger that thinks it's serviced by that? Instead of a genuine walk with Jesus. I know the hardest thing I do when I used to travel a lot was when I, particularly with a new group of people who've never met me, it's how do I become Wayne the brother instead of Wayne the author?
Yeah.
And I've never had, since I was not a pastor, I've never had the trappings of leadership. But when you think, if you're really going to help someone, you need to be alongside them as a brother, not over them as a leader. In the sense of, I get to tell you what to do, or I get to create the program that you have to conform to keep your salvation secure in our way of thinking about it. Yeah. And I just go, okay, none of those lessons have seemed to sunk home into instant. And I know we're talking about Catholics because we just saw the service, and it's more ornate than most, but it's been around for 2,000 years. Correct. There's a lot of those similar trappings, whether it's Anglican, Lutheran, Baptist, whatever, you can find similar expressions of the same kind of thing. Conformity-based, opulence at the top of leadership. You're building a palace for God. This was Stephen saying, God does not live in buildings made with hands. But the only way you justify building a St. Peter's Cathedral, particularly 500, 600, 800 years ago, when people, that would have been ridiculously expensive to pull, plus the engineering involved in pulling that kind of thing off. And they built them all over Europe. And this was the thing that people, and they paid for it by selling indulgences, which was your loved ones in purgatory. And so if you pay X amount of dollars, we can get them out early. And then who wouldn't do that? You've got to do that for your loved one who preceded you in death. And I mean, all of that was orchestrated. So you can sit there and look at this service, and all the kings and leaders of the world have gathered to watch this. You've got the ecclesiastical hierarchy surrounding it. And I'm fascinated by the pageantry of it all. And I'm disturbed deeply by the underlying spiritual realities it seems to convey to the world.
Yeah, But I feel like this has been the tension since over the history of mankind, this has been the tension that we have been navigating, right? Whether you have the Tower of Babel and we're going to try to build a tower to be able to get to God, get closer to God and to Marduk, our manufactured deity. And yet, like, when Jesus came and said, I have come to fulfill the law, I've come to fulfill Torah, I've come to show you what life with Father looks like, he was challenging the Jewish religious system of that time where he was living. And he said, I'm coming to challenge this. I'm coming to show you what it means when you're looking at these different laws that have been created, or even if it, as simple as the Ten Commandments, right? Because I love that statement of it covets itself right out of existence, right? And I feel like even in religion, we covet the power of influence over humanity, the ability to control, whether it be financially or spiritually or existentially, we covet. And in some regards, I feel like we are coveting ourselves out of existence, and it's happening right before our eyes. Whether it is the papal burial or it's the the individual who needs the private jet so that they are not getting influenced by the poor, meager individuals of humanity.
No, it's the tube full of demons. That's what they were concerned about.
Correct.
Tube full of demons. Yes. Yeah, you can't fly all day with that and come out and teach at night.
Oh, heck no. No. That's going to influence my prayer and my spirituality, my ability to be able to hear the voice of God.
So. And it's not just in these ecclesiastical settings. I mean, you have the same thing going on with competition for, you know, viral videos and internet presence and book sales. And you got to put a best-selling author on your book because you want to find an identity to get someone to buy it. And it's incredible how much the same competition and covetousness exists throughout humanity. It's not. I mean, here, I think we here in Catholicism, you see, well, what are you going to do? You got this huge building, you've got all this stuff, you've got to have somebody in charge of it. And so now you've combined the life of Jesus with a human institution, and the life gets sucked right out of it. I think this goes to what Paul was saying about having a form of godliness, which you definitely see in that whole thing, but denying the power thereof, the power of Jesus to change lives, the power to not get them in a system and following the rules, attending mass, going to confession, saying Hail Marys. It's not all that. It's how do we connect people to the living Christ and let Christ change them?
Yeah.
And that's not even, I don't think Protestantism gets that a lot. I don't think charismatic evangelicalism gets that a lot. It's always about leaders who tell us what to do and we follow them. And people like us, or people that listen to the God Journey, I think, are people who've said, okay, the religious systems of our day don't thrill me. My faith may have begun there, but I reached a point in my growth where my faith came in conflict with the conformity needs of an institution, the leadership demands of people who want to be followed unquestioningly because they are the pastor, thank you very much, or the bishop or whatever. And so they move outside of that and then have the thought, who am I?
Yeah.
All these other people validate this, think it's worthy, and the presidents and kings of the world come to sit down at royal, and they're not even Catholic, a lot of the countries that were there or the people who were there, but it's all the... You get to the upper echelon of society and they all hang out together.
Yeah.
Whether they agree on stuff or not, doesn't matter. We're the movers and shakers. And so we've got to all be together in the same place and act like this is significant in term. And it is, he's a significant worldwide leader who died. That's true.
Correct.
Whether he's, and the institution he represents is the embodiment of the gospel is another story, but they're fully convinced it is. And I don't mean the kings and whatnot attending. I mean those in Catholicism, and particularly at that level of bishops and archbishops and all those kind of, they're genuinely convinced this is the way the gospel was meant to be expressed in the world. And I can't find anything in my heart to even put a handle on that, even understand it.
See, that makes me think of... Have you seen the movie Angels and Demons with Dan Brown?
Another wonderfully spiritually enriching film.
But there's a conversation between the main character and one of the bishops. And his comment was, when you write about us, do so gently. We are a human system, a flawed system filled with flawed people who are seeking to live a life of faith. And that was that because I just watched it the other day and I remember thinking about that and being like, okay, I can appreciate that. So where, like, because it's hard, like I feel torn because, like you said, that here is a group of individuals who have dedicated their life to this thing, and they have foregone a lot of the other experiences that people have out of a desire or a commitment to their belief in this thing. And man, that, I guess the question I would have is, so what would God's heart be for the people who see it as a human system filled with flawed humans, but are still wanting to seek a relationship and live a relationship dedicated to God and doing it through this system? Is there a way for God to express himself through that?
No, I think absolutely. I think that's how you can have a guy like Pope Francis kind of emerge out of this that seems to have such a beautiful heart that represented Jesus' gentleness and kindness and compassion for people who are broken and hurting and finding ways to love them. I think that's probably the best it can produce.
Yeah.
So is God going to make use of anything that we humans put together? I believe it's true. I think he's going to be there. And I don't think we can consider enough the ocean we grow up in and swim in.
Yes.
And so it has all these accoutrements, but we think it's genuine. And because we do, and we seek God there, God makes himself known to us. We think that validates the system if you're part of it. But I'm more concerned about people. I wouldn't try and talk one Catholic out of, you got to stop going to this thing. This is going to ruin your walk with Jesus. I just wouldn't. I'm more thinking about those people like me who've said, no, those systems are not where it's at. And so for me and my faith and my growth, I'm looking for a different expression of community, more like the simple expressions that Jesus used in walking with the disciples and Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And there was more of a rich communal relational reality. And if he even desired us to have a little bit of this kind of system, he did nothing to point us down this road.
Yes, completely agree.
In fact, he said a lot of things that would not allow you to get there. Like, don't lord it over others. You know, the greatest among you be the servant of all. And so there's a lot of things that Jesus talked about, the whole conformity approach to rules and regulations. It's just another law. It's not Moses' law. It's church law, church canon. But it's still, I pacify, maybe that's what we talked about earlier, that sense of belonging or the sense of whatever we need, that we use it for that. And I think a lot of people do. If I belong to that and I follow these hoops, I've assured myself that this gets me into heaven and I'll be fine at the end of the day. If I'm not, it's 1.4 billion other people, they're going to be in a heap of trouble.
Yeah. Right?
And you can take this whether you're Catholic or Baptist or Mormon. Mormons have created a similar kind of opulence in a very short time.
Yes.
And so it just amazes me that religious passion goes the same way that political passion does or business passion does, which is toward competition, toward opulence, toward we've got the right way of doing this, and if you don't do it, you're wrong. I'm more concerned about the person who's just said, okay, I don't fit there anymore. And then they second guess their life in Christ instead of, no, find that rich life in Christ and where Jesus wants you to be involved with his family in the earth. And don't worry about, I'm not jumping through those same hoops, because I don't think those hoops can be validated by anything in the New Testament. Not the mass. I mean, think about the kind of fights Catholicism went through in the early days. Like the one to be the, who would be the premier bishop? It would be the Bishop of Rome. That was a fight. And the other bishops didn't want to give into that. And then it was, I read this in a Catholic history book of how when the Roman Empire was fading away, the same families that were cultivating their children to fight for the next emperor, they started moving him into the church to be the next pope. It was the same, because the Roman Empire went into the Catholic Church. That's why there's so much empire dynamics to what the Catholicism is around the world.
Yeah.
Is because, and then if you start something new like the Reformation, now you got Anglican and Wesleyan and other kinds of forms, they all start out to be more genuine, relational, simple, but they all trend toward the same, because you've got a system to protect and what's the best way to protect it. And some groups use the collegiality of elders, and that's a little different than having a head president or whatever. But we seem to always, most of them seem to get to president of the denomination. And then, you know, if you love him, you love him. If you hate him, you have to get him replaced by somebody else. It invokes all of the accoutrements of humanity and seems to deny the power of the gospel and the joy of really help people live deeply in Christ instead of just becoming a cog in a machine and satiating, like we talked about Luther satiating his guilt by this imputed righteousness idea. Yeah. But you got the same people who go to mass or confession or go to service on Sunday morning, and they don't necessarily love it, but they feel like that keeps me safe. That gives me something that it soothes my conscience because a lot of other people soothe as well. And then we tell people, if you're not connected to, this is a famous Catholic quote, but you cannot have God as Father if you don't have the church as your mother. Which I've heard even people quoted in charismatic circles going, really? You're going to go that way? That the church, and that by that they mean the institution. They don't mean the reality of the bride of Christ in the world. They mean the reality of this institution, which doesn't recognize that institution over there. This one is the right one. Oh, no, we're the right one. This is the way it's got to be done. And what I love about the way I live this now and the people I relate to is nobody that I know who seriously lives in the life of Jesus would be willing to tell people, this is the way you have to do it, and you got to do it this way. And if not, you're going to hell, or you're going to some dark, horrible place, or you're going to be lost forever. They don't talk that way. It's they found a life in Jesus that they love to share and invite others to be a part of, but it's not, this is the only right way to do it.
I guess for me, as I am thinking about it, I can't fathom what it's going to be like when Jesus completely eradicates that from the human experience. To me, there's so much joy and anticipation for what is it going to be like when that fear is removed, when that feeling of insignificance or need for power, that hunger, that longing for dominance, when that is completely eradicated. I my mind can't even wrap around that idea. And I thoroughly enjoy the rest and peace that is ever growing in my heart as God has been continuing to expand who he is to me, my understanding of his love, our relationship, the settledness, the rest, the lack of necessity to be a thing. Like even just the other day, there was a situation that came up at our college where it looked like a power grab. And some people at my institution were pretty fired up about it, that there was some things that I was doing that it looked like a couple of the other local companies in the area decided to power grab and to wave a banner about. And there was watching the response of these individuals be in angst, a state of angst, because, oh, well, you know, somebody else is taking the credit for the hard work. And there was just this settledness of who cares as long as it's getting done. Like as long as people are getting access to well-trained mental health professionals that have a desire and longing to serve our community, who cares who takes the credit for it? What is the value of that? There was no, like, it was just this really interesting experience sitting there watching the frustration and angst of some individuals and sitting and being like, that's not where my identity is found. And I didn't do the work that I've been doing out of a sense of please pat me on the back. I did it because it needed to be done for the sake of people in my community. That's why I did it.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's an interesting, but to have that completely eradicated, like not a tint of that anywhere.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That is heaven. Wow.
But you're rare. I mean, they're most people are, I've done seen with writers where, you know, you collaboration, great stuff happens. And then somebody wants all the credit. Somebody wants all of this or all of that and the money. And that's the way this works. If you can get credit for it and get it on your CV, then the next thing you go and apply for, oh, wow, look, you organized this whole program for Sheridan. You may not have been involved till the last minute. Oh, I've had so much of that in my life. We joke about how much we could get done if no one cared who took the credit. And yet 99% care about taking the credit, even if they don't deserve it. Yeah. But I love it. I'm with you. I can't wait till the day when that stuff's no longer important and Jesus becomes all in all. And it's his work in people's lives. And people get to, it doesn't matter who gets credit for this, but right now it matters because it's monetarily manipulative. There's things to do if you can get credit for something you didn't do.
Yeah.
And you, and if you're going to be selfish enough to do it, and other people are not going to be selfish enough to fight you for it, then you get away with it.
Yeah.
And so, no, yeah, I too, I yearn for the day when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ, because that will be awesome.
It will be. And I think that's the good news of his love, right? That the more that I know and live out of the identity of the beloved, the less hold that stuff can have. Because my sense of worth, my sense of love, my sense of affirmation, my sense of grounding isn't found there anymore. It can't be stolen anymore because it's authored by his love. And that, man, that's good news.
That is great news. But few people can live there. I even wonder now, I mean, within a week, we're going to be into a conclave now. And
yeah.
In the chapel, Sistine Chapel, to try and figure out some guy get 2/3 of the vote. There was just a big movie called Conclave, where it kind of shows the political, from people that have never been in there, but people who assume what it is. And it somehow that's going to produce. I kind of think of that thing from The Crown where Elizabeth is anointed queen when she's 18 years old or 19 or something, very young. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop something, stands on the side of it and he says to somebody else, "This is how the girl becomes a goddess." And that's what I find fascinating. When they finally pick somebody, the guy that was sitting in one of those rows at the funeral, a nondescript, nobody knows who he is, suddenly he'll come on the balcony and everything now is orchestrated to make him a god. And with a little g, I don't mean to replace God, but to elevate his status, because the Pope is not another human being with a good heart. The Pope is the vicar of Christ and his voice on the planet, and whatever he says has to go. And so you've got to take a normal human being and do something in the pageantry that makes him appear to be something he's not, and that he can exploit to maintain the faithful doing what needs to be done for the institution to survive. And how far is that from what I, as I read the Gospels, how far is that from the Jesus of Scripture? And yet we have watched over 2,000 years, whatever split off from the church becomes, even when the Eastern Church, and this, I don't know if you saw that part of the ceremony, where the Eastern Church came in and the costumes they were wearing, and I don't want to call them costumes because I think they're very holy garments, but oh my gosh, how can you not think this is like a clown show? Like you could have, 20 people come out of a Volkswagen and stand there. I wonder if it's like when those young girls on American Idol or some show, the more they start to win, the more tarted up they make them for the records to sell. And I wonder if that's part, and it's got to be the first point. Said, I can't wear this. I feel naked in it. I would imagine some young girl would feel that way. But no, just you're fine. We'll do this, this. And then finally, it becomes the way to dress because success demands it. The illusion, the record company, whatever, whoever's backing you needs you to do everything you can to increase every possible thing. And I find it sad that the life of Jesus gets confused with that same environment, whether it's the opulence of its buildings, whether it's the loftiness of its leadership, whether it's the code of law that we've got to follow to somehow please Jesus. It breaks my heart that we live in a day when even probably less accepted now than it was 50 years ago when Sarah and I started our journey together, but still so far from the life of Jesus, so far from what he calls us to be and how we get to experience that in him.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.